This Texas Matters podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, what is it about Austin? The Texas capital city has a creative energy that is the envy of the world. How did that happen? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Austin is one of the fastest growing cities in the nation. Tech giants like Google and Amazon continue to expand there. And it's hard to say what is rising faster, the rents or the commute times. One could say Austin is a victim of its own success. How did Austin become a destination city for the young, talented, and ambitious? Before Austin became successfully weird, it was small and overlooked. Texas writer Joe Nick Patowski writes about the strange trip that Austin took. His book is Austin to ATX, The Hippies, Pickers, Slackers, and Geeks Who Transformed the Capital of Texas. I asked him if having an Austin was inevitable.
Going back to the founding of Austin, when, you know, Mirabeau Lamar famously shot a buffalo near the corner of present-day 8th and Congress. He was on a hunting expedition, the second president of the Republic of Texas, and visiting the village of Waterloo. And when he shot the buffalo, his hunting party rode up to the hill where the state capitol is now located and declared, this should be the seat of empire, which is a pretty crazy idea considering at the time Austin or Waterloo was on the edge of the frontier, completely surrounded by hostile Comanche territory. And so you think, you know, what was this poet doing or what was he thinking? And, you know, the founding was not because there was a waterway or this was a crossroads or a trade route. The Colorado River, this part of the Colorado River was not navigable. I mean, there was basically no reason for this to be established as a town, city, much less a seat of empire. So does that make it inevitable? I keep looking back to, you know, the one element of the oldest business in Austin, which isn't as old as the Menger Hotel. And certainly Austin is a much newer city than San Antonio is. But, you know, the fact that the oldest business in Austin is a German club that was founded for the purpose of singing, making music, and drinking beer, to me kind of informs the populace. It shows that the pursuit of recreation and pleasure and music is kind of baked into the DNA of the community. But for saying all that, the inevitability, I don't think anyone saw it coming until it really happened, beginning in the early 70s. And things started coming together. And, you know, that inevitability, when people quit moving away, if you were aspirational or had ideas, even hippies moved away. They went to San Francisco because that was the big time in the 60s. But when people started moving in the 70s for music, and notably the San Antonian Doug Somm, who'd come back from San Francisco, was in the, you know, the throes of psychedelic music. He was right in the middle of it all. Comes back to San Antonio, gets beat up by a Bexar County deputy because he looks different. Because he's got long hair, and he comes to Austin, and the hippies that are going to San Francisco, it's like, hey, wait a minute, this guy came back, and he thinks it's cool. And then, you know, a washed-up country music singer who's 40 years old and should be selling insurance and country music gears, Willie Nelson, stumbles in here. It's those people started drawing other people moving to Austin. And the inevitability of it being discovered for music is pretty obvious. What I don't think anyone could have predicted was how these different in-migrations would build upon each other. Because after music, you get film, you get food, you get South by Southwest, you get all these institutions. And then you get the great disruptor in the 1990s, tech, which really does, you know, it powers the economy. But I think my whole riff was that nowhere else do you find the culture informing the economy like you do in Austin. And it's an alternative culture. It's not, it's alternative culture that's been mainstream. Low arts, music, film are now, you know, these are industries in Austin. As is food, the fact that Whole Foods started in Austin, the world's largest organic retailer. And of course, with Central Market and HEB coming in to compete in the 90s, you know, and spread all around Texas. This was, you know, these things were all happening in this one place. I couldn't have predicted it when I arrived in 1973, but I sure have had fun watching it evolve.
I'm going to push back a little bit on the idealized version of events with Mary Bou Lamar picking the location as the capital of the Republic of Texas. The second president of the Republic of Texas, Lamar, was pretty out front about his ambitions and he was determined to have the extinction of the Indian race, and he was very much opposed to Mexico. He relocated the capital of Texas from Houston, where it was named after his predecessor and nemesis, Sam Houston, and he wanted to relocate it in a place where it would be free of other racial tinges. Didn't want to go back to San Antonio, which was the largest city at the time and where it had been the capital before, because he didn't want it to be too Mexican. I'm wondering if this view of race is Austin's original sin.
You know, Lamar, you can look at, I mean, I'm looking at him as a poet who, you know, seat of empire is a mouthful.
No, Lamar's claim to fame is not his poetry.
No, he's a noted, he was the leader of Texas who exterminated Indians and you know, led that charge. As far as racially pure, again, this is a place that when he shoots the buffalo, they're surrounded by Comanche. So no wonder he wants to, you know, move them all out and make this, you know, the real estate project that Stephen F. Austin had envisioned from the beginning. I mean, these are colonists that they're trying to move in. Same thing in Houston. Not to say, I mean, there is a significant Mexican population in Waterloo, and there was a significant Mexican population in the early days of Austin. You know, I'm just saying his desires, whatever they were, whether it was ambition fueled or not, this was really a wrong reason to establish a capital. And generally, capitals are established because they're centers of commerce. They're the largest cities. They're near a waterway or transportation center. And Austin had none of these things. So I'm looking at it more from that respect. And as far as the two presidents of the Republic butting heads, you know, it didn't take long. Once Lamar had his way as president and moved the capital, that Houston, as soon as he got reelected, moved it back. I look at it more that Houston, the place as capital of Texas, all well and good, but you know, it's also a swamp, it's malaria ridden, and I could see aesthetic reasons for moving it to a pretty place. And as I look at Texas today, every city, every place has its virtues and its positives, but no place has the aesthetic beauty of Austin, period. And, you know, it starts with places like Barton Springs. San Antonio had Barton Springs once upon a time, and they let it go and go to hell, and now it's been revived. But it's not a place you can swim year-round, and it's not a community center like Barton Springs is, and that's within a mile of downtown.
You're talking about San Pedro Springs.
I'm talking about San Pedro Springs, which I'm pleased to see has been reopened on a very limited basis. It's hard to swim there if you're a swimmer. Even in the summertime, the hours are pretty limited. And that kind of is just the difference that I think Austin figured out what it had. And even though these natural features and attributes have been compromised, especially over the last 50 years, it's still there. And when people come, they see a different Texas than they see elsewhere. And I think that's it's always been a place that's marched to its own drum, a different beat from the rest of Texas. And decidedly so in the last half century. You know, everywhere else in Texas, I disagree with the description of a blueberry in tomato soup as former Governor Perry described it. It's more like a blue island in a Red Sea, but that island's growing. And Austin attitude is spreading throughout through the suburbs and into neighboring counties, and it's infecting places like San Antonio. This is part of the Austin influence, and I find it to be, you know, as much as it's changed over the last half century, and for people that have been in Austin for that period of time, you know, they've experienced nothing but loss. A lot of the things that they really like aren't there. They're harder to do. But what I kept looking for were the same things that attracted me in 1973. Was that in effect today for someone that just arrives? And meeting people just this last week, talking about my book, that have moved to Austin within the last 2 months, for them, it's their kid in a candy shop. It's not my Austin anymore, but it's their Austin, and they see these attributes, which are separate and apart from the rest of Texas and the Southwest, as positives.
So I think the question that your book is exploring is, what were these attributes that Austin was able to grow and become, and so that it offers something that no other city in the United States offers? There are some rivals, maybe Seattle or Portland, but Austin did it first. And how did that happen? And is that still there?
Well, that's something that I've tried to explore throughout this book. And I use this term, two terms, doing things for all the wrong reasons and the alternative Austin business model. And this is about really alternative people, starting with hippies and even going back to beatniks and beats, which, you know, there were always those communities in Austin, you know, before the mid-20th century, thanks to the university. But it was really when it was more hippies that stayed. And, you know, it starts with, hey, let's start a concert hall. No one's looking at a business plan. I mean, there's no seed money other than Bud Schrake loaning Eddie Wilson $1,000 to, you know, for your music hall idea. But, you know, this was all the wrong reasons that the Armadillo started. But immediately, the Armadillo World Headquarters wasn't just a concert hall. It was a community center and cultural center, and there was nothing like it between either coast when it opened in 1970. And similarly, it's the same thing with the Austin Film Society, which today it's the hub of the film industry in Austin, and there's a film industry. It's not just a place to go shoot films. It's not just location. It's directors. And the Austin Film Society doles out hundreds of thousands of dollars of grants every year to aspiring filmmakers. And it wasn't started where, let's start an institution that Austin film can revolve around. It was Rick Linkletter and Lee Daniel, two guys with cameras, and they loved watching movies. And they figured out, Rick had worked offshore in oil, to save up enough money to buy a movie camera and enough money to live in Austin for 2 years. And he runs into this guy, Lee Daniel, who became his main cameraman. And they both discovered that the University of Texas, they showed some pretty cool films, experimental and foreign films, but they were all by professors teaching a course. So after the first year, they'd seen all the films. Their whole idea for this Austin Film Society, which is its own theater, I mean, it's a big deal. It has its own class of producers, was two guys sitting around, hey, let's form a club so we can watch more movies. That's not really a great business plan. And that's not really like a vision. And same thing, South by Southwest was started by a bunch of people that saw this need for, how do you connect bands, independent bands in Texas, in Austin, with the music industry in LA and New York? So it was a music event first, and now it's like technology and film beast, although music is still at the heart of it. Certainly Whole Foods opening up started a whole food movement, along with the urban farm movement, which is pretty unique in the fact that you have urban farms in the city in East Austin, which is the original plan of Austin was to do all this urban farming in the eastern part of the town. That's back when they had 250 farmers and only, I think, 10 lawyers. I think the script has flipped since then. But it's just these ideas that people have. Let's do this. four women meeting in a bar with this guy that has a really whacked out idea, and they get rid of the guy by the time they meet again. But these four women got together and they started women's roller derby, reviving an old kind of moribund TV sport that had, you know, lost its appeal in the 1950s and 60s. But we're going to make it all women, and we're going to do it for ourselves, and it's kind of empowering. And how many, it's thousands of roller derby leagues later, all around the world, that idea started in Austin. All the wrong reasons. No one was saying, let's start international roller derby. Let's revive. It's outside people getting together and working out ideas. And Austin remains an encouraging creative space. So no matter what your ideas are, whether it's technology, whether it's books, whether it's film, whether it's music, there are all these informal community centers, a Waterloo Records, a Book People, the largest independent bookseller in Texas. These are great hangs. Or you just go to whatever the Austin Film Society is showing, and you're going to get educated real quick in cinema and cinema history. So it's these things being available for people that are different, and they're wherever they came from, they didn't have that community. They were looking to find other people like themselves. And that's the place that I wrote about in Austin to ATX.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio, talking with Joe Nick Patowski about his latest book, Austin to ATX, The Hippies, Pickers, Slackers, and Geeks Who Transformed the Capital of Texas. If someone were to build an Austin from the ground up, what would be the lessons that they should learn from the history of Austin?
Okay, well, it helps to have the Capitol and University. Those, everybody talks about those as the institutions. And even, you know, and up till 1970, you got a degree from UT, and you're supposed to go to Houston or Dallas or San Antonio or somewhere else to seek your fortune. If you stayed, pretty much your only options were working for the university or the state. So those institutions afforded people the ability to what I call it's the groove. There's a pursuit of pleasure that, you know, it's fine to work and you know, even work in tech 80-hour weeks, but it's very important to also be able to unplug at just the drop of a shoe and go recreate, because it's the kind of place that basically encourages people to kick back and relax. So it's the groove. It's some kind of secret sauce, something cosmic. But that's where I was really worried that when I moved in 1973, Austin had the lowest cost of living of the 100 largest cities in the United States. I mean, that's just the way it was. Today, it probably has the highest cost of living in any city in Texas, except Midland. And my whole take was, okay, as all this growth has come and all this money has entered the picture and all these people still, they're trying to commodify cool. And you really can't commodify cool. But if all these change and especially the money comes in, can you still have cool? And again, this is where I resisted being a cranky old curmudgeon and saying it was better when I got here. Which is always true. It's always best whenever you first arrive in a place that you fall in love with and you determine this is my place. And once you do that, you're going to see nothing but decline after that point, because it's never going to stay the same. Change is constant. But what I was really looking for is someone in their 20s like I was. If they come to Austin, are they finding the same kind of opportunities and the ability to express themselves that I found? And I found enough characters that affirm that. What the big difference is you could slack. You could be a slacker. You could be an artist. You could be a groover way back in the 70s and 80s and really not have to worry about money because it was just so cheap to live. Now you can be an artist, creative, but you really have to have some entrepreneurial spirit to be able to afford to live in this place, because Austin is really suffering this danger of becoming a theme park like San Francisco or Manhattan, where it's only people of a particular wealth can live. A Polish journalist asked me this week, he said, you know, what do you think of Austin being the Monaco of the Colorado, on the Colorado? And I was like, what? He said, well, you know, Monaco in context of Europe is like this, only rich people can go to Monaco. You can't be poor and be in Monaco. Poor people live elsewhere in Italy and they commute in. And that this is a problem with that Austin's facing now. The good news is there's recognition by city leadership and the moneyed class that, you know, we don't want to lose our creatives. We need to figure out a way to keep creatives here. But in the meantime, creatives are following firemen and teachers and policemen and moving to the older, you know, moving to older suburbs or, you know, small towns like Lockhart. You know, San Marcos has always been, in many respects, kind of a suburb of Austin, even though people don't like to hear that in San Marcos, but it has a lot of Austin qualities. So my sense is, while the core is at risk, you already have these satellite scenes in North and South Austin and in smaller communities where they're kind of Austinized. And to me, that's a good thing in a way, because it's all about preaching diversity and openness and tolerate and being tolerant. Those are the elements that make Austin what it is. And that is, you know, not so much the state, but certainly the university has always been that place. If you were different and you grew up in Floydada or down in Sinton in the early 20th century, you know, you were probably ostracized. But you come to Austin, it's like, well, you find some like-minded people at least. Well, that same thing has just grown exponentially to where it's, you know, the alternative has become mainstream. And it really kind of defines what the city's about, even though the creatives that built it may not be able to afford it.
In your book, Austin to ATX, there's a lot of personalities that you cover, people who have helped define this trajectory of coolness that Austin is able to put together. A lot of great ones that a lot of people know, and then some of them maybe not so much. I really appreciate you put Richard Garriott in there, Lord British, a video game pioneer. Lance Armstrong, he used to be someone who was like Mr. Austin. And then, of course, came the scandals and his blood doping situation. But you still include him as someone to look to for a definition of the Austin groove.
If I had a character that was conflicted, and I was not even sure I was going to use him, it was Lance Armstrong, because, yes, he was the second one-name superstar in Austin, the first being Willie, of course. And, you know, the fact that he did this exotic thing, bicycle racing, he did wonders for cycling in Texas. And I did point out that he, you know, convinced the legislature when they were going to ban bicycles from farm-to-market roads in Texas. That was really a thing for a while. He was a big enough celebrity that he swayed the legislature. But, you know, I wasn't looking at him as that guy, other than the fact that, you know, the Austin we're talking about also is, especially viewed from the outside, is full of itself and has a certain amount of hubris. Well, there's your walk and talking example. Lance Armstrong, multi-champion of the Tour de France, that basically lied his way and doped his way to prominence, like all other cyclists did. But he hurt people along the way, and that was because he was big and he was accused. And ruining the lives of others is not a good thing. So that's not the Lance I was writing about as much as why I wanted to write about him was his unsung role in saving the longest-running music series on television, Austin City Limits, by starting up the Austin City Limits Festival. He got tired of parades after winning Tour de France's, and because he was hanging out in Austin clubs like the Black Cat and Liberty Lunch, he said, well, why don't we just have bands instead? You know, this isn't Austin. Parades are stupid. And because he had this wherewithal, all this money, he basically seeded C3 Presents, the concert promoters that ended up doing all of Barack Obama's events, and was sold to Live Nation for $151 million, some outrageous fee. Well, Lance started that, but by starting the festival, he saved the television series and afforded them new equipment, also the ability to move into the state-of-the-art facility that they're in today. So that's why I put him in. But also, I wanted to put in this guy that you know, wasn't such a good guy. He did some good things, but he also did some bad things. And where I'm not trying to accentuate the negative in this, I'm just trying to figure out what makes this place the way it is. And he played a very instrumental role. And to deny that would have been, even though I had editors that didn't want him in and publicists that said, we can't use him, we don't want to talk about him. But I just felt like, well, he's part of the story. And even though that, you know, he's not necessarily a positive beyond what he did for Austin City Limits.
Has Austin lost its groove?
David, that's a hard question to answer. I'm right here, as I sit here today, I'm on the cusp. Again, the problem's been recognized. There are attempts to address the affordability issues, particularly regarding musicians. When you lose the musicians, do you lose your groove? Just like, you know, I have issues, and I tried to address this too, that, you know, the race issue of the one part of the city, East Austin, that had significant African-American and Mexican-American communities has basically been gentrified and pushed the African-Americans and Mexican-Americans who gave these communities its heritage into the suburbs. There's no more room. There's no more parts of town where they can occupy. So it's more like you sell out if you were fortunate enough to own in East Austin. And if you're Black, you go to Pflugerville or Round Rock. And if you're Brown, you go to Kyle or Buda. That's where it's going because the city's now been circled by suburbs. But on the other hand, I started thinking there never have been in most of the 20th century ethnic communities in Austin. The only reason that East Austin was Black and brown was because of segregation laws that were passed in 1929 dictating that Mexican Americans and African Americans had to live in East Austin. Before then, they lived, Mexican Americans, African Americans lived in all parts of Austin. So in a way, it's people say, oh, it's a white person city. It's lost. It's had a declining African American population. One of the few major cities that's had that. It's just like the music. In the 1970s, there was really the music that kind of changed everything and put Austin on the map. Was this weird, you know, welding together of country music and rock and roll and roots music, paying attention to where music came from. It was no longer just progressive country. It was like, what music tribe are you? No matter who you were, you could come to Austin and find your tribe, your community. And that's what I see today in the city is like, it's more diverse than ever. My whole take is, whichever way Austin's going to go, we'll know in the next 20 years. There's awareness that there's problems. There's leadership that, you know, wants to try to address those problems. There are still alternative people moving in. At the same time, there's a legislature that can't wait to bash any new ideas that Austin has. Bag ordinances, tree ordinances, these are terrible things. The mother state's going to tell you what to do. Well, you know, that's where Austin's going to continue to, I think, not only be what it is, a cool place to go to, but it's going to remain the exception to the rest of Texas until the rest of Texas starts adapting to Austin rather than the other way around.
Joe-Nick Patowski has written extensively about the culture of Texas. He's tackled topics like the Dallas Cowboys, Willie Nelson, Selena, Doug Somm, and now Austin. His book is Austin to ATX, The Hippies, Pickers, Slackers, and Geeks Who Transformed the Capital City. Patowski will be appearing Tuesday evening at the Twig Bookstore at the Pearl in San Antonio. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You can also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. That's where there are past Texas Matters episodes to listen to. And you can find us wherever you get your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from